Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, we begin today by talking about water. First, the king tide that crested just a few hours ago. A true king tide happens just once a year in January when the moon, the sun, and the earth are closest to each other. Today's tide rose more than 12 feet in Boston, and WBUR's Barbara Moran watched. She's in the studio now to tell us about it. Hi there.
Hey, Deb.
So what happened?
So the king tide is the biggest tide of the year, and I went down to the waterfront to see how it looked. I walked down from Long Wharf down to the seaport, and it wasn't flooding, so I didn't see any flooding, but it was a really high tide. It was about, 6 inches below the walkway in a couple places.
And so how does this tide compare with previous tides?
Well, we've seen some pretty big tidal surges. Usually they're accompanied by a storm or high winds or something like that. You might remember like last March and January, there was flooding in the seaport, the aquarium, T-station flooded, that kind of thing. So there's nothing like that today, but we can probably expect to see more of that in the decades to come.
So what are the long-term effects? What are folks saying about that, about these tides and about rising sea levels?
Well, because sea levels are rising all up and down the coast, the tides are higher, relatively higher. So there was a NOAA report that came out last year saying that these high tide flooding are, there's twice as many as there have been 30 years ago. In 2017, 2018, Boston had 22 high tide flooding. And this is flooding of areas that, didn't flood decades ago, right? Mm-hmm. That they're built above the high tide line, so they're not supposed to flood. And sea levels are expected to rise in Boston by about another foot and a half by the end of the next century. So that means a lot of these areas, the areas that I saw that were just, 6 inches above the water, those areas be a foot underwater and by the end of the century.
And so what are officials doing about this, state and local officials, city officials?
City officials. Yeah. So the city of Boston has a climate ready action plan. They're looking at a bunch of different ways to deal with sort of this increased level of flooding. Experts really think that once sea levels get higher in the coming decades, there could be monthly flooding in low level areas. So they're looking at different ways to deal with this, changing the flood zoning areas to make more of Boston a flood zone. And this would require buildings to have a higher first floor or have these like sacrificial first floors that are designed to actually be flooded. They're also looking at other mitigation efforts like building out parks or wetlands like in East Boston and in Fort Point that would be able to sort of withstand flooding. So there's a lot of these different projects under consideration. Some are underway, but there's a lot of coastline around Boston that's really prone to flooding, and it's getting worse.
All right. Well, WBUR environmental editor Barbara Moran, I'm sure we'll be talking with you more about this. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Deb.
Another area affected by rising waters is housing. According to a new report today, more than $400 million in real estate value has been lost because of sea level rise. Researchers from the First Street Foundation in New York looked at some 2.5 million coastal properties in New England. It found Massachusetts homes were hit hardest. Almost $275 million in lost value between 2005 and 2017. For more, we're joined by Jeremy Porter. He's a professor at Brooklyn College and a lecturer at Columbia University. He worked with First Street to produce this report. Professor Porter, you're on the line, I'm told. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
In studio with us is Barry Bluestone. He's founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy and a professor at Northeastern University. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here.
Also with us in studio is Joe Rossi. He's chair and executive director of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition. That's a nonprofit that works on flood hazards. He's also a flood specialist at Rogers and Gray Insurance. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. Do you live on the coast? Are you worried about the effects of rising sea levels on your property? Have you noticed changes in your property value? Are you doing anything about it? Let us know. Join in. Ask some of our experts for some advice. If you will, you can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Professor, I want to start with you. Can you just give us a brief overview of your report?
Yeah, so our research looked at the impact of tidal flooding and the impact that increased tidal flooding over the years since 2005 has had on property values. And what we found was that properties that flood are not gaining in terms of appreciation as fast as properties that don't flood, using traditional modeling techniques that allow us to compare homes to one another.
Mm-hmm. And so it would seem almost like, well, I would guess that properties that flood aren't gaining as much in value. What's significant about this?
Yeah, it's interesting because the housing development has sort of met a point in time where now sea level rise is starting to interact with that development. We're starting to see places flood that didn't flood in the past, and now all of a sudden places that were safe for as long as we can remember are now flooding, and homes in that area are starting to lose property value. There's actually this negative economic signal.
Hmm. Where in Massachusetts was particularly hard hit?
Yeah, we saw Salisbury was a particularly hard hit area around the Boston area. Quincy, the whole area, and then the Revere area were all particularly hard hit.
And when you say hard hit, why was it these areas? Are we talking about the amount of money that's potentially at risk here?
Yeah, it's a combination of the two. So it's particularly hard hit because of the amount of inundation. But then in those areas, there are also middle class to, in lots of cases, very expensive homes right on the coast. And when you start talking about negative appreciation for homes that are worth as much as a lot of these homes are, it's going to add up very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And give me an example, say Salisbury. Why would Salisbury be at the top of the list?
Salisbury, just the topography of Salisbury, it's low-lying. It has the way that the marshes and the river inlets and the back bays are set up. It's one of the places in the Boston area that is extremely susceptible to flooding. So it's primarily revolves around the topography of the area.
Mm-hmm. Professor Barry Bluestone is with us in studio. What do you take from this study?
Well, of course, we've studied housing at the Dukakis Center for the last 15 years, and we've looked at the appreciation. Of course, we've had very rapid appreciation. This is new information for us, and I'm glad that we have it, because what we're seeing, of course, is looking at individual communities, not just the whole greater Boston area. And I think we need to go back and take a look at what's happening in communities in low-lying areas. I presume that what Professor Porter has found is going to be true along much of the coast. It's probably also going to affect some of Cape Cod and perhaps also affect some of the North Shore around Rockport, Gloucester, and so forth.
Do you think home prices, I mean, we're talking about this rapid appreciation. Everyone's complaining about the cost of housing, particularly around Boston. I mean, are we seeing any of these effects now?
I presume we are. Professor Porter's numbers are going to be better than what we have right now, and we'll have to take a look at that in future reports. But I think it's pretty straightforward. If you're living in a flood zone, you either know that sometime in the near future you're going to have a serious flooding problem. It probably also means you're going to be paying a significant amount of increased money for insurance. Mm. And, of course, if you factor in the insurance cost into the cost of the home, the cost of the home itself is going to go down to offset the increased cost of insurance.
Well, that is a perfect introduction to Joe Rossi. Joe, how are you? What kind of effect are you seeing here?
Well, that's a great segue, because what we have developed over the last year and a half to 2 years is this term. You know, we all hear about climate preparedness and climate resiliency, but there's really a new term now called personal financial resiliency. And how do you take on this burden of increased insurance costs in certain areas if you have to have insurance, or if you don't and you want the insurance available to you to take it? And one of the things that we've seen over the last few years is the availability of data is either encouraging or restricting the ability to sell in some of these properties that are seeing repeated flooding or haven't flooded, and there's a perceived or actual risk to flooding. And what I mean by that are things such as elevation certificates, loss history. And loss history is something that we've really focused on the last 2 years, because even though there's this move in the insurance industry within flood to start to move some of the insured markets to the private flood insurance carriers, they still rely on the federal government's loss data in order to make the judgment on whether they will insure some of these risks. But we don't yet have a way to to communicate loss history to a potential buyer unless it's given to that buyer. And a lot of the times it's not done out of somebody trying to hide that loss data. It's done because someone may not know. Loss history goes back to 1978, so you have to, and it goes by the building, not the individual owner.
I see. But you're using that now in terms of setting rates?
Well, for the private industry is using that data to set rates, and it's probably going to be something that is used to restrict the availability of insurance moving forward as we see the federal program reformed in 2019.
Okay, I want to make sure we get some callers. And a reminder to our listeners, we are inviting you to join this conversation. Do you live along the coast? Are you concerned about property values because of rising sea levels? And what are you doing about it? This, of course, in light of a new study that says properties are losing value because of rising sea levels. Our number here is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. John is calling from Marshfield. John, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. I dabble in real estate a little bit. I have concerns about your statements of loss from 2005. One, you picked, you started in the year that was basically the peak real estate prices for the last real estate cycle in the state. And now the up cycle that we're in now, everyone says, sure, things are expensive, but I hate to use an ocean metaphor, but a rising tide doesn't lift all boats. So are you sure that Are you sure about these figures? Are these
blanket figures? Well, we have the author. We have the author with us, John. We can ask him. Okay, so are we sure about these figures? And what? I'm sorry. What was the second half of your question?
And one other thing. So, say if you're paying $4,000 a year for flood insurance because your property got put into a flood zone in the past couple of years, you capitalize that out at say 5%. That's $60,000 really, basically off the value of the property. Are you factoring that in as well, or is it just a blanket coastal property values have gone down?
Okay, well, Jeremy Porter, Professor Porter, how would you answer John's question?
Yeah, so all of our analysis from 2005 to now have been based on real estate transactions. So we have all of the real estate transactions that the counties have recorded. We ended up developing a model that allows us to compare homes to one another by setting all the amenities even. So number of bathrooms, number of bedrooms, square footage, et cetera. But we also included controls that accounted for market fluctuations. The biggest one we found was the 2008 recession, but there's been seven other macro-level market fluctuations that we included in our models. And then we had something in there that allowed us to control for neighborhood desirability. So we also had a third control in there, or another control in there, that accounted for how some neighborhoods simply recovered faster or at different rates than comparable neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So all of our models look at observed real estate transactions, but then set even all of these outside forces. So the model itself basically is comparing two homes to one another with the numbers that we end up being able to pull out are based on the independent effects of flooding as opposed to some of these other spurious confounding indicators.
Professor Bluestone, you want to add something?
Yeah,
here?
Professor Porter, I presume that what you're really looking at is the difference in appreciation where you have a rising market. That is,
absolutely,
what you were able to find was that, yes, property values have gone up. They've gone up very much in Massachusetts, of course. But what you have found, I presume, is that in floodplain areas, those property values have appreciated much slower than in areas not affected in such a way.
Okay, yeah, I wanna...
Absolutely. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Professor. Sorry.
I was going to say, absolutely, if you thought about it, it's two different trajectories. Places that are not flooding have a much steeper upward trajectory. Places that are flooding are still going up. We're still seeing absolute increases in property values for most homes. It's just not as steep in terms of the gains.
Okay, I want to take another call here. Amanda is calling from Gloucester. Amanda, you're on the air.
My home flooded last January. It's right on the water, and I'm wondering if you would expect these events to happen more often, and if so, if this is going to affect my property value.
Okay. What would you say to someone like Amanda? Joe Rossi, what would you say?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, are these events happening more often? There's a lot of different factors that go into that, such as the loss of your coastline, the actual events themselves, the severity of those events. But then there's also the increase, and I bring it back to the increase of the cost associated with the events, such as recovery, how much insurance, you know, what's the amount of insurance that you'll have to pay, what is the future going to hold in terms of those costs. I have some anecdotal stories where flood-damaged homes are actually being sold with the promise of being able to be elevated to higher elevations. And without getting into the details, that helps lower your flood insurance premiums and makes you more resilient, and in some cases acquired through federal grant programs. And so those programs are available, and that certainly will help the values of those types of structures, not just now, but going forward. And there was some talk earlier about regulation to increase how high you have to go when you elevate your home. In Massachusetts, we have a unique situation where you can't do something that's more restrictive than the building code, but the building code itself is getting more restrictive in a positive way, and then hopefully in the future we'll see things getting even more restrictive so that homes, even though we may not like the types of structures we see way up in the air, those are the structures that are going to be able to sell better and hold their value for a much longer amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Barry Bluestone, I wonder, do you think that when you look at this market, it's hard to believe that people are taking this into account as they consider their real estate purchases or sales? Is that, are they? Or
I'm sure they are.
Really?
I mean, the fact is that people are more conscious of what's happening to our environment and our climate because of all the organizations that are now working on this. Number two, for virtually all but the very rich, your home is the largest asset you have. You don't want to make a mistake in an investment in a house, because a home is not only a place to live, it's an investment. And you're going to be very careful about what kind of investments you make. I mean, even if you can buy, you're going to want to know what does it cost to elevate that home, even if you can get some federal loans to put your house on stilts. I mean, I love the idea of living right on the coast. I'm very fortunate. I have a home in Truro. But 30 years ago when I bought it, even then I was concerned about it, and I am 100 and some feet above sea level. The joke in our family is rising sea level will have oceanfront property in another 80 years. So those are the kinds of things that I think people begin to take into account. They would not have done this 20, 30, 40 years ago, most people. Mm-hmm. Today, I think they are taking into account, and that's why Professor Porter is seeing a real effect on the prices in those markets.
You would agree, Professor Porter, as I can hear from what you're saying on the other end of the phone there.
Absolutely. Our research published with Stephen McAlpine followed up on two other academic studies, one out of Harvard that showed that people are taking into account elevation, and a second, out of Colorado and Penn State that said that savvy real estate investors are really driving this decrease in property value and property value loss by having access to resources that allow them to understand risk better than the average home buyer.
You know, I do want to say we spoke with someone from the Cape today, Ryan Castle. He's CEO of the Cape and Islands Association of Realtors. And he said that he really isn't seeing a huge effect right now in terms of how people are taking this into account when they're dealing with their real estate needs. Let's listen.
Homes on the Cape and Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, are still in demand, especially waterfront property. We have not seen a decline in homes that some people indicate may be affected by sea level rise.
Professor Porter, you first. What do you make of that?
I think that homes are in demand on the coast. And even in our modeling, we have a special control where we take into account homes that are right on the coast, and we don't allow them to actually impact the property loss values because we see that they're not they're much less sensitive to sea level rise compared to homes that are right off of the coast that experience flooding. And again, it's not that homes aren't appreciating in value, it's just that they're not appreciating as fast as homes that don't flood.
Okay. I want to go to another call. Barbara is calling from Sagamore Beach. We have lots of folks on the Cape talking to us today. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to point out that even though my house is on a cliff where I am, I'm technically not in a flood zone. But I can tell you that the properties that are on the very top of the cliff in my backyard are very much affected by you know, the flooding and the cliff eroding, and their properties went down probably almost half of their value when they tried to sell and get out of there. So it's not just a matter of putting your house on stilts. You know, you got to think about the overall erosion and what you can do to mitigate that. And, you know, the Cape is all private septic systems, and that plays a big role in what we're doing in addition to the climate warming.
Okay, Joe Rossi, what would you say about that? About, you know, it's not just about elevating your house. There's a lot of other things going on.
Yeah, acquisitions and are just as important as elevations, and I think that's something we try to talk to people about, which is, you know, the flood programs, grants that are available aren't just to elevate homes. They're also for acquisitions, and we have a few of those we're working on right now where they just don't want to be there anymore. We don't blame them because of situations like that. But I think there's a couple things that have been said here that tie so well together with this. First is the demand versus value. I think you have to separate those, because you can have high demand at the coastline for homes if the valuation of those homes is right, and those valuations are going to be different than they may have been based on, you know, what we've seen in this report. And then we talked a lot about information, and, you know, is the awareness there about flooding issues? And I can tell you that we see so many people that come to us, and the first thing they say is, I'm looking for a home. I don't know where I'm looking yet, but I want you to run flood zone determinations based on where I'm looking, just so I know. In fact, to the point where at the Coastal Coalition, we just contracted with a company that people can actually get these determinations on their own now without even coming to an agent or a real estate agent, because they need to know and they want to know, are these homes in or out of a high-risk flood zone? And then finally, I'll say that, you know, we say in or out of a flood zone. Everyone's in a flood zone. That's the term we like to say, just how severe of a flood zone are you in.
I want to mention something that's really significant, because it just came up at the end of last week, and this is Governor Charlie Baker. He spoke at the Heinz Convention Center last week and brought forward a proposal that he says would raise $1 billion over the next 10 years. To help with climate mitigation, and he wants to raise this money by increasing the real estate transfer tax. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
We would then use it as a loan program, a grant program, and other kinds of assistance to communities for climate smart investments, which could involve stormwater upgrades and dam and flood controls, drainage and culvert improvements. This is such sexy stuff. I just love talking about it. Drought mitigation strategies, nature-based solutions, and other adaptation strategies.
All right, that's Governor Charlie Baker. But he does want a 0.2% increase to the deed excise tax. And he's set to formally unveil this soon. Good idea, Barry Bluestone?
Yes, it is. You know, I've been looking at a lot of the challenges we face around affordable housing, climate change, transportation. And one of the things that is central to taxation is to try and relate the issue that needs to be remediated or the type of program you want to develop and who pays for it. In this case, what Charlie's doing, somebody who's been opposed to most tax increases,
right,
is taking a tax that would actually create the kind of mitigation that would help save property values, and saying the people who, in a sense, are going to benefit from this should help pay for it. And the way they do that is through a real estate transfer tax. So when they sell their property, they are helping to pay for that mitigation. Now, I haven't seen the details of the governor's proposal, but one possibility is to think about having a real estate transfer tax that varied a little bit depending on where you were in the floodplain. We're all in the floodplain, but some of us are in deep water and some of us in shallow water. So that I could see using that in a way that you would have communities that are really seriously impacted should be paying more because their property is going to be affected more. And you could almost think about a community being a condo association, right? You put all the people who live in a particular community in a floodplain and say, look, you're basically in a condo association. We're now going to assess you some funds so that we can postpone or eliminate a much higher cost that you may face if we don't do this mitigation. So I think the real estate transfer tax is a well-targeted tax, precisely being paid by those people who will be most benefited by how it's spent.
And last word, Professor Porter, any recommendations from this research about the best way to go forward?
Yeah, we built the Flood IQ tool at floodiq.com simply to give people access to information so that they can go in and look at their own personal risk. They can understand the potential cost of owning homes in specific areas and really just to level the playing field and give people the opportunity to have the same information that investors have when they're looking at real estate.
All right. Jeremy Porter, professor at Brooklyn College and lecturer at Columbia University. He worked with First Street to produce this report. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Barry Bluestone, founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy and professor at Northeastern. Thanks to you.
Nice to be back.
And Joe Rossi, chair and executive director of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition, a nonprofit on flood hazards. He's also a flood specialist at Rogers & Gray Insurance. Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait. Don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.